please address the fact that there are two candidates vying for the same pool of votes.
A debate in Juneau showcases the similarities in the campaigns of Bill Walker and Mark Begich. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for October 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska's top federal prosecutor highlights cooperation between law enforcement agencies.
All these people involved leaving their egos at the door and doing what's best for the state of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says she's getting a record number of calls and emails about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, which may be up for a procedural vote on Friday. Her office won't say how those communications are divided, whether pro or con, but Alaskans urging a no vote are making their case loudly. And as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, the ACLU is flying dozens to D.C. to deliver their message in person.
Murkowski says she hears you. Or at least she knows there are a lot of you weighing in on Kavanaugh.
I can truly say that the volume of incoming that we are receiving in different ways of communication has been unprecedented.
More than healthcare?
Yes, I believe more than healthcare. That wasn't the case initially, but certainly in this past week.
The last big deluge to hit Murkowski's office came last year in the lead up to the vote on repealing the Affordable Care Act. Since then, the senator says they upgraded their phone system and their email processing. They thought they were ready for heavy volume. But she says the voicemail boxes fill up in the first hour.
We've hired additional staff to do nothing more than to sort through the volume of calls that have come in overnight.
The high volume reflects the passion the Kavanaugh case has inspired. Alaska has a sky-high rate of sexual assault, and many Alaskans are telling Murkowski that confirming an accused assailant to the Supreme Court would tell victims they don't matter. Others tell Murkowski not to ruin a man's career for an accusation that isn't proven. Murkowski's spokesman won't provide the numbers, but she says people of all perspectives are contacting the senator. And scores want to make their case in person. For weeks, advocacy groups have flown Alaskans to D.C. to urge Murkowski to vote no. More are on the way. The American Civil Liberties Union is sending about 100 Alaskans to the nation's capital this week. Alaska chapter spokesman Casey Reynolds says most of the money is from the national ACLU, but it fell on him to find Alaskans willing to travel on short notice.
Well, it's been pretty amazing. I mean, me and our organizer here at the ACLU just started making calls Sunday night.
He figured it would take a few days to find 20 or 30.
Honestly, by the next morning, we had a list of about 80 people who were like, if you have the funding, I will drop everything tomorrow and make my plane reservations and go. And now that list is up to about 150.
Murkowski's scheduler emailed one group Tuesday and said she'd received 80 appointment requests overnight. Murkowski has said she found the main accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, very credible. And she says Kavanaugh denied the allegation with passion, anger, and conviction. Murkowski also says she was surprised by Kavanaugh's, quote, very direct partisan statements to the Judiciary Committee. But she's not saying yet which side she'll come down on. If the procedural vote takes place Friday, the final vote on Kavanaugh's confirmation could come as early as this weekend. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Independent Governor Bill Walker and Democratic candidate for Governor Mark Begich answered a question today about how they're competing for the same voters. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman went to a Get Out the Native Vote forum for the gubernatorial candidates in Juneau today and has this report.
Juneau Representative Sam Keto III read the question from a member of the audience. Republican candidate Mike Dunleavy wasn't on the stage.
Please address the fact that there are two candidates vying for the same pool of votes. Has a compromise been discussed to ensure that no-show Dunleavy does not win by default of vote splitting? And I'm just reading a question provided by the audience. Our first to...
Begich is a former U.S. senator. He says the candidates must earn every vote. He says the voters will have a choice about who can win and who has the best plan of action for the state.
What's so great about elections is it's in your hands. It's not in ours. It's in yours. I think whoever gets to 38 or so percent wins this race.
Walker says he built a cabinet that drew from the entire state because he didn't discriminate based on partisan affiliation. He says the candidate spent the first term addressing the state's budget crisis.
You know, we have wrestled with the fiscal issue, but we wrestled it to the ground. We stayed here, we didn't quit, we showed up, and we did the hard work.
Walker says he's angry that Dunleavy didn't attend.
It was very disrespectful. Neither he nor the lieutenant governor could get the courtesy of attending today. I'm embarrassed as an Alaskan that we have somebody running for this office who will not show up in this room.
Asked for a reaction, Dunleavy emailed a statement. Quote, Bill Walker should be more embarrassed by his failed record of a weak economy, vetoed PFDs, and skyrocketing crime than by my campaign schedule, end quote. He also said he lived in rural Alaska for 19 years with Alaska Native people. Dunleavy's campaign said he had multiple meetings in Anchorage Tuesday. Libertarian candidate Billy Toyen slapped his campaign bumper sticker over Dunleavy's nameplate. Toyen is a hotel concierge. He says he doesn't have a problem with vote splitting.
I think it's all about voting your conscience. It doesn't matter who is or isn't running. Win, lose, or draw. If everybody decided to throw their vote away by voting for me, I would win.
Dunleavy did attend a candidate forum at the Anchorage Aviation Museum on Monday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The state will not charge officers who fatally shot a Fairbanks man last Christmas Eve. An Alaska Office of Special Prosecutions report says three state troopers and two Fairbanks police officers lawfully used deadly force against 20-year-old Cody Iyer. Citing the report, Fairbanks police spokeswoman Yumi McCullough describes what police and troopers say led them to firing on Iyer.
Mr. Iyer did point his gun at the officers and made some pretty strong statements towards them that made the officers fear for their lives, the lives of their fellow officers, and they were close to a residential area, and we needed to make sure that that threat was stopped.
The report says officers were initially contacted to check on Iyer by a friend in Wasilla who said he'd seen him on Facebook Live talking about killing himself. Iyer's mother subsequently called 911 asking for help, saying her son was depressed, had been drinking, and had left the house on foot with a holstered handgun. The report says Iyer repeatedly threatened to kill himself and gestured his gun toward responding officers as they followed him along roads on Fairbanks's east side. The report says the five officers fired more than 40 rounds in two volleys at Iyer, in between which they say he remained a threat. First aid was administered, but Iyer died a short time later at the hospital. The fatal wound was to the back of his head. Iyer's handgun was not fired and only carried a single round. Speaking remotely from California, family attorney Mark Choate says they are disappointed with the Office of Special Prosecution's report.
The decision to not prosecute does not mean that the shooting was, quote, justified, unquote. The decision to not prosecute simply means that the special prosecutor determined that he could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the conduct was criminal. We remain convinced that the evidence will show that Cody's death was a result of poor training and judgment by a swatted-up group of officers who failed in their primary duty to protect Cody.
Cody Iyer was Alaska Native, and his family believes race was a factor in how law enforcement responded. They are preparing a civil rights lawsuit and plan to issue a press release soon. And Iditarod Musher, who is the Republican nominee for a competitive Kansas congressional seat, is facing scrutiny about details of some of the biographical information he shares with voters, including about the last great race. Steve Watkins' campaign website featured a since-removed testimonial to his heroic leadership when a deadly earthquake shook Mount Everest during an expedition. The guide he quoted says he never said that. Watkins also has acknowledged that he was inaccurate about a claim that he started a business in the Middle East and expanded it from 3 to 470 people. And while he claims to be a devoted sixth-generation Kansas resident, property records show he has stronger ties recently to Alaska. He participated in the Iditarod this year. Iditarod competitors question whether that was a publicity stunt for the campaign, including four-time champ Jeff King, who described Watkins' self-portrayal as an adventurer as a gigantic fallacy. Iditarod officials forced Watkins and rookie musher Tara Cicatello to withdraw from the 2018 race in Unalakleet after they'd fallen too far behind. Cicatello told the Associated Press that Watkins' main concern following the withdrawal was publicity and speaking engagements, and that Watkins flew away and left his dogs that had carried him more than 700 miles in the care of overworked volunteers in Unalakleet. Watkins is running to represent Eastern Kansas's 2nd District. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Southwest Alaska airline Penn Air is headed to the auction block tomorrow.
I hate to see a homegrown Alaska company get sold to an investor outside.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
Climate change and rising sea levels are threatening remote Alaska villages. And they're also hitting other low-lying places around the world, from Bangladesh to the Pacific Islands. Local leaders from all these places are gathering at an Indigenous Peoples Conference in Girdwood this week. They're going to tell stories, network, and agree on shared principles to guide their advocacy work. Pelanice Alofa is one of the participants. She's from Kiribati in the Pacific Islands, and she told Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk that her country of tiny islands is extremely vulnerable to climate change.
Kiribati is very low. The highest is like 3 meters above sea level. That's our highest point on the land. And we have so much water, oceans. So our vulnerability comes from the sea level rise that is causing coastal erosions and taking away our lands and water problems, because we have a very low length and it can get contaminated very quickly. And if water comes in from the ocean into our wells, then we have a whole lot of water supplies contaminated by sea.
Do you have any stories yourself of things that you've seen?
We've been to some places where people have been relocated. And I've been to a family, like the whole land got washed up by sea. Like one day, the water just came up, washed over their whole land, and then you cannot get that water out. You know, you cannot pump it out. It just flooded the whole plantation that they have and where their home was situated. So they moved. When I went to this village or to this family, they were not there. I was looking around for them. Where are these people here? I only see the left or what remains of their homes, but people were no longer there. I asked and they say they've gone to stay with their extended families. So there are internal migration or displacement of people.
Not everyone in Kiribati thinks that climate change is something that we can stop, or some people think that, like, God should be stopping climate change.
When we first started working on climate change, there were some people that felt that way, especially the religious leaders. They've all changed today because it's more than 10 years we've been working on climate change and they've seen it. They've seen what's happening right at the community level. And when you are in your office and you don't go out there and see what's happening, then you can continue to talk like that. But because we've been working with them and we've been showing them and we've been taking them to where we were working with our communities, and then they couldn't say it's not real. They've changed.
What kinds of things are you hoping to learn from this conference here in Alaska?
If I return home, I want to share the stories about the people here, how they were able to adapt to the impacts that they have and the challenges that they have. I want to take that. But at the same time, I want to share my stories, how we are facing the challenges that we have. If we come up with the solutions here, and I know we will come up with solutions while we're here, that's the one I'm going to be taking home, and I do not know yet. It's we've just started.
Pelanis Alofa is participating in an Indigenous Peoples Conference in Girdwood this week. She spoke with Nat Herz from Alaska's Energy Desk. Today, federal officials announced a number of charges in a high-profile violent crime that happened last year in Anchorage. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the Justice Department says the case is an example of growing partnerships between federal, state, and local law enforcement to do a better job prosecuting violent crime.
Speaking at a press conference flanked by prominent police and prosecutors, U.S. Attorney Brian Schroeder says his office is charging 5 Anchorage residents with serious felonies like drug trafficking and kidnapping. Schroeder says the alleged incident happened in August of 2017 when a victim suffered extreme physical injuries.
As a result of being beaten with a baseball bat, a metal broomstick, and stomps to the head, he was then put in a dog kennel. And the defendants ordered another man, at gunpoint, to get rid of the victim.
The injured man was brought to the hospital and has since recovered enough to cooperate with law enforcement. Speakers cite the case, along with several other recent examples, as evidence that they're working together more closely to investigate and prosecute violent crime in Alaska. Schroeder says convictions in federal cases can bring heftier sentences that are determined by the seriousness of the crime and a defendant's criminal history. He also points to the recent state charges against Peter Wilson in a high-profile Kotzebue case as stemming from local police partnering extensively with state troopers and FBI agents.
Both these cases reflect, I think, one very important common factor, and that's all these people involved leaving their egos at the door and doing what's best for the state of Alaska.
Federal sentencing guidelines for the kidnapping and drug charges in the Anchorage case range from a few years to life in prison. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
What's known as PFAS contamination was the focus of a U.S. Senate subcommittee hearing last week. The session brought together government officials and citizens from a growing number of communities like Fairbanks and North Pole, where groundwater has been polluted by perfluorinated or PFAS chemicals from firefighting foams. There are thousands of PFAS chemicals, and Alaska is one of the states that recently changed its health advisory level to include more of the compounds under the EPA threshold. The EPA number is based on just 2 common PFAS chemicals, but the director of the agency's Office of Ground and Drinking Water, Peter Gravatt, told the committee the EPA stands behind it.
We believe that our health advisories are supported by the strongest science.
Gravatt said the EPA plans to release a national PFAS management plan by the end of the year, which could include a recommendation that PFAS chemicals be classified as hazardous substances. Gravatt cautioned the designation would take years to finalize. Linda Birnbaum with the National Institutes of Health testified that research reveals statistically significant associations between PFAS exposure and specific health problems.
These include potential effects on children's cognitive and neurobehavioral development, immune system dysfunction, endocrine disruption, obesity, diabetes, lipid metabolism, and cancer.
PFAS chemicals are used in a wide range of products, and most of the general public tests positive for them at low levels. The Senate committee working on the PFAS issue will continue to take public testimony through October 11th. A regional growth plan for Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks has just been released. As KUAC's Robin reports, the plan looks at the impact of a 50% population increase at the base with the upcoming influx of F-35 fighter jets.
2 F-35A Lightning II squadrons will be stationed at the base in the next 4 years, with the first arriving in 2020. Borough Mayor Carl Castle informed the Assembly that work has already started on the suggestions made by Agnew Beck Consulting. The project firm was hired to examine what happens when about 4,000 more people move into the area near the airbase.
We're taking the growth plan very seriously and acting on it already.
The analysis estimates 2,000 of those new residents will be under the age of 17, causing a severe shortage of space for elementary and middle school students. The report notes there is already a shortage of affordable child care options in the borough, and the newcomers are going to bring about 800 children under the age of 4. The plan shows new growth has been an economic boost to the area, with lots of new housing under construction.
It recommends that we form a housing task force in our community, and we've already done that. FEDC, Fairbanks Economic Development, has taken the lead on that. They've already held a meeting and did a tour at some the facilities in North Pole where we're seeing housing construction going on.
In addition to housing, education, and child care, consultants examined planning and zoning, developing the civilian workforce, public safety, transportation, utilities and infrastructure, health and social services, and even quality of life. Castle says the plan involves the private sector in improving growth.
Foundation Health Partners are already planning a health clinic out in North Pole because one of the gaps we have in our delivery system here is lack of health care on the east side of town where we're going to see the major part of the influx.
The plan is on the website EAFB for Eielson Air Force Base, regionalgrowth.com. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
A Bethel man was fined $100 yesterday for advertising moose meat for sale on Facebook. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
Arnold Loopy's arraignment was held Monday in Bethel, but Loopy did not appear in court or call into the hearing. The defendant has a criminal history, but this is his first offense of this kind. Loopy received a minor offense for posting an ad showing gallon-sized bags of moose ribs for $25 each. Trooper Walter Blajewski told the court that he'd contacted Loopy, and Loopy told the trooper that he had not sold any of the meat, but that he had posted the ad.
He made admissions that he did it. However, he made admissions that he wasn't necessarily aware of the regulation when he did it.
The maximum charge for the offense is $500, but Trooper Blajewski recommended a fine of just $100, and the court accepted. After the hearing, Trooper Blajewski emphasized that troopers are not patrolling Facebook, but that selling big game meat is illegal in Alaska, and so is advertising the sale of that meat.
The troopers that I know of and myself aren't trolling Facebook looking for cases to develop, but when one gets brought to our attention, we're going to investigate it like any other violation or criminal offense.
Loopy did not respond to KYUK's message requesting comment. Trooper Blajewski reports that he is investigating one other Facebook post advertising big game meat in the area. He encourages people to call troopers if they're unsure of any regulations. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Penn Air is headed to the auction block tomorrow, more than a year after the Southwest Alaska airline filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Court and company officials have declined to name the prospective buyers who submitted bids last week, but residents say they're hoping for more reliable service. KUCB's Laura Craigle has this report.
Lauren Devine says she's had a lot of unfortunate experiences flying Penn Air.
With customer service, with reservations, with flights being delayed, canceled.
Devine has lived and worked on St. Paul Island for years. Penn Air is the community's only option for traveling to and from Anchorage. And Devine says many of her friends and neighbors have similar frustrations.
Loved ones not being able to get to their medical appointments, to be able to go to their family's funerals. Things that could have been at least mitigated by forming a better relationship with the community.
Bad weather and long distances make it challenging to fly in the Aleutian-Pribilof region, but Devine says residents understand that. It's the airline's poor communication that bothers them. So now she's hoping that whoever buys Penn Air takes more time to connect with customers.
When your flight is canceled, as it inevitably will be, how are you treated? it's really important to just feel like they're doing their best. They're trying to take care of you. And I think that's something that Panair just never did well in our community.
While Devine is eager for a fresh start, others are still rooting for Panair's current owners. On Alaska, Vice Mayor Dennis Robinson says he'd like to see the Siebert family buy out and relaunch the airline that they founded back in 1955.
I'd hate to see a homegrown Alaska company get sold to an investor outside.
Panair's service to Unalaska has been inconsistent, just as it has in St. Paul and the Pribilofs. But Robinson says the Sieberts understand rural Alaska and its reliance on air travel, so he's optimistic they can improve.
My personal hopes is that it's the same family that's owned Panair. It may not be called Panair, but I think it would be a good thing.
Panair CEO Danny Siebert has declined to comment on the competition for his business or say whether he's made an offer himself. The auction opens Wednesday at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. According to the trustee overseeing the sale, a federal bankruptcy judge will choose the winning bidder based on their offering price, of course, but also on their plans for Panair's 430 employees, 10 airplanes, and 8 routes across Southwest Alaska. At this point, the trustee says he's not expecting mass layoffs or any sudden changes, although the new owner will be free to adjust once the sale is complete. That'll happen sometime after the judge approves the sale and after the Federal Aviation Administration and Department of Transportation sign off on it. While the judge has scheduled a hearing for Friday, there is no set timeline for the government agencies. Panair will continue operations until the process is complete. Airline officials and the trustee have promised that the sale will not affect holiday travel or the busy winter fishing season. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
Officials at SeaWorld say an endangered and rescued Cook Inlet beluga whale is thriving in its new theme park home. The whale was flown from the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward to SeaWorld San Antonio in March. SeaWorld officials say the whale has grown to nearly 400 pounds and measures about 7 feet long. In a statement Friday, SeaWorld San Antonio senior veterinarian Steve Osborne said the whale is eating fish and interacting normally with the other 9 beluga whales at the Texas park. That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robin and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anne Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Nat Herz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, and Laura Craigle in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Starting October 1st, all of Alaska will be protected from the harmful effects of secondhand smoke because all public places across the state will be smoke-free. Everyone can now breathe easier as they work and play. Smoke-free workplaces and public spaces protects the health of all Alaskans. It also protects our youth from ever starting smoking. So if you do smoke or vape, please take it outside. For more information about the new smoke-free workplace law, visit smokefree.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.